Good morning. I'm Chris Bailey, and I am honored to be your convener this morning. I'm also a member of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, and I'm also a board member at large. Whatever faiths you have known, wherever you come from, you are welcome here. Whomever you are and whomever you love, you are welcome here. And whether you ran in this morning on eager feet, walked in, ambled in, rolled in, you are welcome here. And on behalf of the fellowship, I extend our welcome to any guests or visitors, including Emily Wagner, she's the director of the Manhattan Emergency Shelter Incorporated, or MESI, as some of us call it. And we invite any visitors or guests to please sign our guest book on the welcome table in the narthex. On that form, you can request a complimentary subscription to our newsletter. The greeters and I will be available after the service to answer any questions about our fellowship activities and programs. And please join us for coffee and conversation in the narthex afterwards. And down the hall and to the left in the Alsop room, we're having our annual holiday craft and bake sale. Before we begin, I would draw your attention to the announcements printed in the order of service. And to open our service, I would recall the words of Laurel S. Sheridan, who said, "Take from life its coals, not its ashes. Fan the flames of love and justice. Join hands and hearts in common endeavor, and there will be no limit to what we can achieve together." And we always start off with a chalice lighting, and Carrie and Austin Roberts are doing that, and in honor of that, I'd simply say the chalice is the symbol of our open and inclusive tradition. It's appropriate to reflect upon a quote from Adlai Stevenson III as we ignite it once again. "I like to think that one of our most important tasks is to convince others that there's nothing to fear in difference. That difference, in fact, is one of the healthiest and most invigorating of human characteristics, without which life would become meaningless. Here lies the power of the liberal way, not in making the whole world you, but in helping ourselves and others to see some of the possibilities inherent in viewpoints other than our own, in encouraging the free interchange of ideas, in welcoming fresh approaches to the problems of life, in urging the fullest, most vigorous use of critical self-examination." And to get us in the mood, the UUFM singers have prepared two numbers.
It really should be, surely should be, yes, it would be. it nice, but don't forget the cinnamon. Cinnamon, cinnamon, don't forget the cinnamon. Cloves and spice will make it nice, but don't forget the cinnamon.
Cinnamon,
cinnamon, don't forget the cinnamon. Cloves and spice will make it nice, but don't forget the cinnamon. Cinnamon, cinnamon, don't forget the cinnamon. Cloves and spice will make it nice, but don't forget the cinnamon.
Now's a time when we can share those significant joys and sorrows we carry in our hearts and minds. And we'll have a microphone come around. Please wait for the microphone.
A lot of you already know this, but arrangements are in the process of being made for me to get married to my worthiest Magic the Gathering partner.
Jim Chanteau. I know the service today is about music, but this week has been one of the craziest music weeks in my life. Almost, I think with one exception, every day or night this week I have been in some musical performance, including shortly here today. Tomorrow will be the first day no music. I don't know if that's a joy or a concern.
Hi, everybody. Molly McGoy. Just a quick joy to share. I think some of you may not be aware, but the fellowship has been offering the teen version of Our Whole Lives for the first time in, I think, over a decade this fall semester. So Jen and Matt Campbell have been my co-facilitators, and we've been meeting almost every Sunday afternoon since September, and we've had a class of seven kids, one from First Congregational United Church of Christ and others from here. And so I think after we get done with this Sunday, you'll see Matt and Jen at regular services and some of our teens at regular services a little bit more, because it's been a lot, but it's been a true joy, and we're going to work on recognizing our students sometime in January. So it's been really wonderful, and I just can't thank the families and my co-facilitators enough for making it happen, and Sandy as well. So thank you to everybody.
Hi, I'm Karen Samuelson, and I grew up in this fellowship, and I am here right now because my mother, Phoebe, had a heart attack the other day, and she's resting comfortably. We're still trying to figure out if things are going up or down, so appreciate your thoughts as we try and figure out, you know, we hope for the best, whatever that is right now.
Christopher Renner, I just want to thank everybody who came out on Friday to help move things out of Marion's ex-house once again. All of the furniture was taken down to the emergency shelter, and my understanding is it was going to be turned around and be sent back out to help rehouse three families this weekend. So we got most of the stuff that remained. As for Marion, things are not looking good. Karen leaves today to go to Indiana. She has an appointment with a psychiatrist on Tuesday to have her tested for dementia. And we'll find out more. At this point, Karen does not plan to come back until sometime in February, and she's not sure that Marion will be coming back with her. Since her granddaughter and great-grandchildren are there in Indiana, if it is a case of dementia, Karen's intentions are to find a facility there so she has her son, her daughter-in-law, and her grandchildren close to her. Okay? Thanks.
Pat Embers, I'm once again very grateful that my husband Ken returned from Vietnam, gone 10 days, visiting the library that his unit helped build and are co-founded, and the orphanage that we support.
I just want to thank you, Chris. I don't know what would have happened without you being there and, you know, front lines to try and help Marion deal with all this. It's really been...
By sharing our joys, we grow and magnify them. By sharing our burdens, they may become easier. And at this time, we invite all children, young or old, up to the front for a story with Larry Weaver.
Hi there. Well, the story today is a story that the Navajo Indians tell. It's about the stars. And so, to start, would you close your eyes just a minute, and I'm going to close mine too, and try to imagine the stars in the summertime. Can you remember what the stars looked like? Okay. What do you remember about the stars, Arthur?
At night, they were very shiny.
They were very shiny at night. That's an important piece of the story I'm going to tell you. Now, again, close your eyes and see if you can imagine the stars that you saw. Well, last night was a pretty cloudy night, but stars that you've seen this fall. I can remember some. Okay. Do you remember any stars this fall? Another one, Arthur?
They weren't very shiny.
Sometimes they're not very shiny because of clouds and things like that in the air. Well, you know, you go to school, and among other things, you learn to read books. Well, Navajo children learn to read the stars. The stars could tell them when to plant corn. The stars could tell them when to prepare for winter. But they thought the stars, and they still think, the stars can tell them more. The stars can tell them how to live their way of life. One of the things that the stars tell them is that all of us are related to everything, not just to each other and to our friends and to people of other races and other countries, but we're related to the trees. We're related to the grass. We're even related to the iron atoms that make up this microphone. We're related to everything. This is a lot like that UU principle, the web of life that we sing about in RE each Sunday. We're related to everything. And if we're related to everything, then the Navajos think we need to be kind and thoughtful about how we use the coal in the ground that we're related to and how we treat other people that we're related to. And so this is a story. You can write the story down there. You certainly could. So this is a story about how the stars got up there and what they tell us. A long time ago, when first woman and first man had just climbed into the fourth world, the sky was black. First woman wanted to write the law. Now, wait a minute. We need to think just a moment. There are some laws that people make, like when I'm driving my car, I have to stop at a stop sign. Do you know any other laws that people make? What? Rose?
You're not supposed to steal.
You're not supposed to steal. That's right. Yeah. You're not supposed to steal money from banks. That's right.
You're not supposed to
You shouldn't steal games from kids. That's right, Rose. You should not abuse children. That's right. Parents have laws that they have to obey. Now, some of the laws that you were talking about are laws like First Woman was thinking about. The laws about how people should behave with each other in order to live happily. Now, you know, there are other laws, too, like the law of gravity. But that's a story for another time. So, First Woman wanted to write the law so that people would know how to live with each other. And she asked First Man, "Where do you think I should write the laws?" And he said, "In the sand. It'll be easy." Now, what would happen to laws in the sand, Nick? They'd get blown away. Yeah, this was not a good idea. First,
or stepped on.
Or stepped on, yeah.
The wall would down.
And the wind would blow them down, that's right. Yeah. It would be a problem. And so, First Man then said, "Well, then write them on the waves." Well, anybody can see that's not a good idea. The waves would wash the laws away. And so First Woman, yes? Oh, I forget things too sometimes, lots of times even. Well, First Woman said, "I know, I'll write all our laws in the stars, in the sky." And so she took her jewels, which were shiny rocks, very shiny rocks, and she spread them out on her blanket, and she picked one up and put it in the sky. She picked another one up and put it in the sky. And about that time, Coyote came by and said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm writing the law in the sky so that people everywhere can always see the law and read them and know how to live happily and peacefully with each other." And Coyote said, "May I help?" "Certainly," said First Woman. And so Coyote took a star and put it in the sky. First Woman put a star in the sky. This is sure taking a long time.
It's like a pattern.
Yeah. And Coyote said, "This is really taking a long time." First Woman said, I know, but we must be careful so that the law is written in the sky so that people can always and everywhere know how to live." So, star went in the sky. Star went in the sky. But Coyote was impatient. He grabbed the blanket and threw the stars all into the sky the way they are today. And First Woman said, "Oh, no. Now the people will not be able to read the laws. They'll have to figure out for themselves how to live happily with each other." And so that is part of what the Navajo look at the sky and see. They see partly how to live with each other, just like we have the Unitarian principles that tell us that partly it's important to be kind to each other. Partly it's important to listen to each other. But the whole law about how to live happily and peacefully with one another, and not just with one another, but with the whole earth, that's something that we're all, Navajo and Unitarian Universalists alike, we're all still working on. And that will be a job for for you to help us all with as you grow up. And one of the ways that you learn how to help us in the future and now is in RE. And so that's what it's time for now. So
when all our hearts go with you, go in joy, our hopes go through. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go through. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
So as some people may know, today is our monthly Helping Hands Sunday. Every second Sunday, the fellowship dedicates its collection to a chosen, usually local, beneficiary. All offerings today that are not explicitly marked for UUFM will go to that beneficiary, who, this month, is Manhattan Emergency Shelter. And I'd invite Emily Wagner, the director, up here to just say a few words about the shelter.
Thank you, Chris. Chris and I have known each other for a long time, so it's always great to see him outside of his work life. First of all, I love coming here. Thank you for inviting me. Your congregation is always so welcoming, so it's nice to come to and see everyone. And I had so many people come and introduce themselves today and greet me when I came in, which doesn't always happen sometimes in some of the fellowships that I've been to. So I will watch the time because I've been told 5 to 8 minutes. And I've been at the shelter for 16 years, and I could talk for years probably about the shelter. So first, it's my understanding that a family from our Adopt an Ornament program has already been picked up. So that is great. And that is what the offertory goes to today, is to these families to help provide them some joy at Christmas. And I do have another family that I'll share about briefly here in a minute, but I wanted to just remind everyone what we do. Our building is at 4th and Yuma, and that is the actual shelter that we house people in. What many in the community don't know is the other things that we do besides just the emergency shelter. We have some transitional housing programs and permanent housing programs where we house individuals who maybe are not going to qualify for other subsidized housing at that time or just need the added support from our case managers to help them maintain their own housing. And so we have 18 units in the community that I write a grant for every year that will pay for those units where we can place families and individuals in those units, and then we provide them the wraparound support to make sure they stay housed. And we've had those programs since 2009, and we have had some very good success stories. And my favorite piece of that is we do have a transitional housing program, which is for families with children. And that program is up to 24 months. And a lot of times these kiddos are kiddos that have had no stability in their lives. And this program allows them 24 months, at least, of that stability. They have the same school, they have the same bed, they have the same bedroom, the same dining room table. So that is what that program is about. One of the families that I have picked is actually out of that program. I'm not sure who else was picked, but I'll share that one. The other thing we do is we have a prevention and rental assistance program. We noticed in the community that there is some assistance to pay for rent when you're behind, but there's not a lot. And we had an opportunity to receive grant funds to help keep people in their homes. And that's what we want to do. And so if landlords are willing, we would like to try to help pay their back due rent if they've fallen on hard times and keep them there so they don't have to come to a shelter, because we do know that coming into a shelter when you're already in crisis can be a devastating thing, and we would rather keep them in their homes if that's possible. The other piece of that program is we can help pay deposits and first month's rent to people who are literally homeless. And there are individuals in this community that are not comfortable staying at the shelter, and they would rather be in their cars or outside, and for whatever reasons those are, and we still can help them get into a place, pay their deposit, first month's rent, sometimes second month's rent, to get them going and give them a home. So briefly, we do have a family that's in our transitional housing program, and this family we see often these types of situations. The sole or the main provider of the family has an illness. He has a seizure disorder and was receiving Social Security disability. He went to work because he wants to work and lost that. And for those of you that don't know, if you start making money, too much money, they do pull away your benefits. And so he lost those benefits and started having seizure issues again, and then some heart trouble, and was unable to work. And so it takes a while to get that those benefits back. They lost their home. They had a new baby. And so mom was not working. So they have a 5-year-old and now they and a 2-year-old and mom and dad. And so we have helped. They are in one of our transitional housing programs. We have helped them get his disability back with some help of a law firm in town. Not Chris's. I pointed to you and I didn't mean to, but Kansas Legal Service and helping do that. And that has been a blessing to them. And mom has actually, they've been in the program for a little over 6 months, but mom has been able to enter a nursing program so that she can get a trade and some skills and be able to find a job as well, because she will now have to be that provider for the family. Disability is not always, it's not a huge paycheck. It's not a huge lump, you know, sum of money that some people think come every month. So to provide for this family will be great. To give these children a Christmas and some items will be great. And the things that they want are you know, fun. They love dinosaurs. It's boys. Mm-hmm. And they love dinosaurs, and they want anything dinosaurs. Dinosaur blankets, dinosaur pajamas, dinosaur books, everything dinosaurs. The parents did not ask for anything, just for the kids. So I will have that typed up and emailed to you with sizes and those things. So, and I apologize that I'm going to have to run. My daughter has a fundraiser today at noon. And so I wanted to come today. I didn't want to send another staff person, so I apologize. I will have to jet out of here to get back to Wilmico to that. So thank you for allowing me to come and speak today. Thank you, Chris, for that introduction. So have a great rest of summer tonight and Christmas and holiday season. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Please rise in body or spirit and or spirit and join us in singing this month's special hymn, which is number 55. And as alluded to in Joys and Concerns, we have our own Jim Chanteau.
The three songs I'm going to play, the three jazzy Christmas pieces. Three Christmas pieces, only the last one's really jazzy. Anyway, it's Ding Dong Merrily on High, Angel, Away in a Manger, and Jingle Bells. Yeah, Jingle Bells is the jazzy one.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. As a child, I took piano lessons from Mr. Cleveland Fisher, an organist at a prominent Washington, D.C. Episcopal church. And every year, early in December, he'd admonish me, "You're probably already singing Christmas carols at your church." Mr. Fisher was accusing me and most of the Christian world, including stores as well as churches, of singing out of season. At his church, they reserved Christmas carols until the 24th of December and sang them through the official Christmas season. I see Kristen nodding her head. Yes, until the Feast of Epiphany in January. During the period of Advent, the month before Christmas, they sang Advent hymns like "O Come, O Come, Emmanuel," and surely there's some other Advent hymn, but I'm betting few of us would recognize it. The idea is that in this season of Advent, we are waiting for the birth of the child. He's not here yet. We're not even certain he'll come, so we're in a time of hope and prayer and quiet waiting. Of course, the Advent-Christmas divide is only one of the many ways that Christmas songs stir controversy. In the early years of this country, the Puritans and Pilgrims hated Christmas music. Actually, they hated Christmas, making it illegal in Massachusetts until 1681. And even after it was legalized, it was at best tolerated. Schools in Boston stayed open on Christmas Day until 1870. Today, there's much less open hatred of Christmas spirit and Christmas music by Christians, though non-Christians may tire of it. And people of various faiths find the ubiquitous strains of Christmas spirit blared in malls and doctor's offices obnoxious. Anyone here feel that way? I thought some might. On the other hand, you have those who keep Sirius or Pandora tuned into the Christmas station, whatever it is, from Thanksgiving through New Year's without fail. Now, is there anybody here who's like, yeah, okay. The variety of Christmas music is staggering. Bing Crosby alone recorded 22,000 different seasonal songs. And so you've got from Bing Crosby to the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, from cathedral choirs to the Vandals. And somehow there are more Christmas albums than anyone could imagine, and so someone is buying them, and someone else is hating them. Perhaps it shouldn't be a surprise that Christmas music engenders conflict. There may be nothing more controversial in religious communities than music. Ask any church that has had an organ fight, you know, whether or not to replace that old organ. Or better yet, ask the churches that have replaced their choir with a praise band. Now that'll get people's blood boiling. Even in this congregation, where we're pretty mellow, not everyone has welcomed the increase of music in Sunday services. But there are sound reasons for lots of music. In our particular case, we are fortunate as a small congregation to have the amazing musical talent that we have and the organizing efforts that Michael donates for our advantage. But it is more profound and more general than that. Much of Sunday services consists of words. That's mostly what I do, right? And words express meaning, but they're not the only way of expressing meaning, and not always the most meaningful way. We need alternative ways of expressing and experiencing meaning, and to that we look to the arts. 20th century Russian abstract artist Vasily Kandinsky may have done the best job of exploring the connection between art and spirit. He wrote this about experiencing color. "If you let your eye stray over a palette of colors, you experience two things. In the first place, you receive a physical effect. Namely, the eye itself is enchanted by the beauty and other qualities of color. You experience satisfaction and delight, like a gourmet savoring a delicacy. Or the eye is stimulated as the tongue is titillated by a spicy dish. But then it grows calm and cool like a finger after touching ice. These are physical sensations, limited in duration. They are superficial, too, and leave no lasting impression behind if the soul remains closed. Just as we feel at the touch of ice a sensation of cold, forgotten as soon as the finger begins to warm again, so the physical action of color is forgotten as soon as the eye turns away. On the other hand, as the physical coldness of ice upon penetrating more deeply arouses more complex feelings, and indeed a whole chain of psychological experiences, so may also the superficial impression of color develop into an experience. And so we come to the second result of looking at colors, their psychological effect. They produce a correspondent spiritual vibration, and it's only as a step toward this spiritual vibration that the physical impression is of importance. Generally speaking, color directly influences the soul. Color is the keyboard. The eyes are the hammers. The soul is the piano with many strings. The artist is the hand that plays, touching one key or another purposefully to cause vibrations in the soul. It is evident, therefore, that color harmony must rest ultimately on purposeful playing upon the human soul. So Kandinsky talks about three kinds of effects of color: physical, psychological, and spiritual. And you can tell by what he writes that his understanding of art weaves together with his experience of music, a passion since his childhood, as both his parents played piano professionally. And like his description of color, music has the same array of effects: physical, psychological, and spiritual. Physical music is vibrations traveling through the air to our ears, and even to other parts of our bodies. People who are deaf, for example, feel music, so they can dance as gracefully as those who hear. And babies as young as 5 months move to music without ever having had a single dance lesson. Their bodies are part of what they hear. Kandinsky writes that painting affects more than the eye, but rather all five senses. And I think music is like that. Music physically affects us, whether we are listening or performing. Music lowers the stress hormone cortisol while raising endorphins, oxytocin, and dopamine, diminishing pain and giving pleasure. This hormone interaction can even stimulate that sense of chills you get sometimes with an extraordinary performance. Anyone ever feel chills to music? That comes from those hormones. And so we can actually feel more relaxed and happier from music. Music can even boost our immune system. Music is more than a piece of sound. It is an experience which draws in our whole bodies. One characteristic of music is its rhythm. In that way, we're resonant with music. Our brain waves travel in rhythm, as does our breath. And our heartbeats push rhythm through our bodies constantly. While music tempo varies much more widely than heartbeat does, slow, relaxing music is really about in that range of a regular heartbeat. And not that we sink to the beat of music, but our music can alter our heart rates. And scientific studies have actually shown now, and I think this is wonderful, that choral groups that sing together can get to a point that their heartbeats coincide. Hearts literally beating as one. So, the physical aspects of music blend in with the psychological. We may feel better when we listen to music, and certainly when we sing. What's more, they blend into the spiritual. The deep breathing required for singing simulates meditation exercises and produces many of the same benefits. The Indian mystic Osho said, "Music is the easiest method of meditation." Music, especially singing and playing, but listening as well, can be a spiritual practice. And it's a heck of a lot easier to focus your brain on music than it is to make your mind go blank. But back to those psychological reactions for a moment. A broad array of factors influences our emotional response to music. The music itself may create a particular mood, evoking the feelings and experience that the composer put into it. We listen to sad music when we're unhappy to help lift our mood, and it works. Of course, it's not all in the music. The music creates associations. Maybe you heard that song with an old friend and it creates nostalgia. Maybe it played at your mother's funeral and makes you sad, or makes you remember her. Maybe it reminds you of a particular place or a fictional landscape or a time in your life or a dream you have for the future. Those associations are personal and vary considerably from one hearer to another. In this season, you may love the song Silent Night because of your memories from childhood, or you may hate it. These feelings run deep, and no one can say they're wrong. And back to the elusive spiritual, what Kandinsky calls the spiritual vibrations. Since music is physical vibration, could it also be spiritual vibration? Pythagoras and other classical philosophers hypothesized a music of the spheres, a celestial harmony that came from the orbiting of stars and planets, a delicate music not audible on Earth, but ringing through the universe. Plato called music a moral law. He said, "It gives soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and charm and gaiety to life and to everything." More than one ancient myth tells of a god or goddess singing the world into being. Since the first ancient Veda was chanted, music has been part of spiritual pursuits. Australian Aborigines blow their didgeridoos. Jews and Muslims sing their religious texts. The Christian tradition claims Gregorian chant and Bach masses, gospel music, and Duke Ellington's sacred blue. Music has a presence that works in our bodies, minds, and hearts beyond and outside of words. It smooths the rough edges of life, awakens our hearts, focuses our preoccupied minds. It is as if music has its own spirit that speaks to ours. Another controversy around Christmas music. You may have noticed how UUs have altered hymns to make them more in line with our theology. Guess what? A lot of UU churches refuse to use the hymnal for Christmas songs, going back to the traditional words. When it comes to tradition, emotion runs strong. We're reminded in this season that stories need not be factually true at every detail to have a deeper spiritual truth, to inspire us and remind us of our values. The deeper truths reside in the story, no matter how questionable the particulars. But there's one more problem we find with the Christmas songs and stories. How do we move to a celebration of birth, of hope, of joy, when so much in our world evokes sadness, confusion, anger, fear, or bitterness? I'm going to take a step back into traditional Advent for a moment because Advent acknowledges what a messy world we live in. The prophets who are read at Advent rant on about the horrors we experience, how the adversaries surround us, how darkness covers the earth, how warfare, oppression, and sin afflict humanity, how the world needs someone to straighten it out. And not much has changed in these hundreds and thousands of years. We may not quake in fear in response to the sun's decline, wondering whether it will ever return. Instead, our fear centers on election results, cabinet appointments, global climate change, and domestic and foreign terrorism. Advent reminds us of our helplessness in the face of all kinds of limitations, the utter inhumanity we can have toward one another, as well as our own smallness in the scheme of the universe. So how do we get from there to the celebration of Christmas? And in the Christian tradition, that comes with the birth of a child. And it comes in other ways, too. I mean, at Christmas, it comes with the change in Scrooge and in the Grinch, with George Bailey's new insight when he finds he has a wonderful life. It can come with the birth of a child. I have a friend whose grandbaby was born more than 100 days early, small enough to fit in the palm of a hand. And seeing the survival and thriving of that little baby helps me know the resilience of the human spirit, that miracles do happen. One way the bridge from Advent to Christmas often comes is through the music. When our hearts are touched and opened by music, we may be able to entertain new spiritual truths. We may find our souls soothed in troubled times. We may find the link that takes us from the strange mix of hope and despair that characterizes Advent to the true joy of Christmas. Now, despite those staunch traditionalist Christians like Mr. Fisher and a few liturgical ministers who do their best each year to fend off Christmas carols until as late in December as possible, we Americans tend to plow right through from Thanksgiving or Halloween to Christmas joy without touching the mire of Advent. And here's where those traditionalists may have a point. We try to shift into the Christmas spirit, the feastings and gifts and songs, without reflection on our human condition. And that's when Christmas can morph into a season of values misspent, to debauchery and family fights and maybe even tragedy. But if we let Christmas come while acknowledging and holding the challenges that Advent brings us, the challenge of letting go and allowing transformation to overtake us instead of trying to force it, then we are ready to truly celebrate. The traditional Advent themes are hope, peace, joy, and love. Our challenge is to face squarely the world we live in with its division, its violence, and its oppression, and nevertheless hold on to hope, peace, joy, and love. Even in the presence of tragedy, hope, peace, joy, and love triumph. And so we sing. We sing whether or not anyone claims we're out of season, by the calendar or by the news story. As Leonard Bernstein said, "This will be our reply to violence, to make music more intensely, more beautifully, more devotedly than ever before. We sing because we know that hope, peace, joy, and love are ours and are the only way that we will survive and find comfort always." Our hymn is number 228, "Once in Royal David City." And the choir is going to help us, is going to lead us in this. The rest of you can stand up, too.
Okay. We can all beat as well.
Once
please join in the responsive reading, number 532. The choir will start us off, and everyone else, please read the italicized lines in unison. And then, in lieu of closing words, the singers will send us off with a very nice piece. So please reconvene after that in the narthex for coffee and conversation. That's reading 532. As soon as I find it. Okay. It's the music of the spheres.
The music of the spheres.
Its rhythms are the equal, repeated seasons, the beating of the heart. The cycles of stars and corn. Rhythms of moon and tide, one single rhythm in planets, atoms, sea. Melody, accord, arpeggios, the harp of the universe, unity behind apparent multiplicity.